On Bob. Tell me about the town, your involvement in the project and all that kind of stuff.
I'm not quite sure how I got roped into the 14-0 initially. I think it had a lot to do with you.
I think I called you, right, or something.
Yeah. So I just showed up, and a bunch of people were trying to get the 14-01 running. They were still having lots of power issues. The German machine needed that special power regulator. Most of the attention had just shifted from the power system to actually trying to bring the CPU logic up. And Ellen was hot on the tape drives getting that running. And
who?
Alan Palmer.
Alan, yeah.
So he was primary on the tape drives, and then Ron Williams basically on the rest of the CPU. And I came in and said, well, how can I help? And we started talking about, Ron already had a plan in mind for the CPU, was making progress on it. But the CPU is able to talk to the card reader and the line printers without the tape adapter unit running, so he was going to ignore that completely, and said if I wanted to, I'd be able to grab that piece of the machine because it could be brought up independently almost for everything else, as long as you've got power. Since the Tau had its own control panel, you could make that an independent project and bring it up. So, great, what's a Tau? As I said, I'd never seen a 14-01. I was familiar with the assembly language instruction set because I was involved in a project to translate the autocoder programs from the 14-01 to COBOL.
My goodness.
So, because I had known quite a bit about assembly language programming and was able to pick up 14-01 fairly quickly, I was a consultant on the project and I was making money in college by coaching people on how to translate. This is probably about 1972.
Okay. So the 14-01 codes were running in 360s, probably in emulation.
They were running 14-01 emulators in the 360s.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they wanted to get rid of the emulators because this was a project by the state of Illinois.
Oh.
They had all these 14-01 object decks. They had lost the listings to a lot of them, and so they engaged a number of people at the University of Illinois. It was a summer project. They rented out whole dormitories, and basically anybody who was in the computer science program had a summer job with the state of Illinois.
Wow.
But so
this is going to be automatic translation between autocoder
and COBOL.
And COBOL, but you've lost the source to the autocoder. It's just the instruction stream at that point.
Some of the programs had source, some didn't. My job specifically was a consultant. I wasn't assigned any particular modules to move. I just had a better grasp of what the machine was supposed to be doing, so I was able to coach people on it.
Okay.
So I came in, and I knew autocoder fairly deeply from that project. I had a very good knowledge of machine architecture because I'd worked with 8080s, which is about the same level of complexity as the 14-01 in terms of the data flow. I worked with IBM in the firmware area, so I was very familiar with the machine to firmware interface of those machines. So I knew computer architecture cold and figured, well, this is a simple machine. I could look at it and figure out how it works. And that would have been great if there would have been documentation initially, but that was the first part of the project. Is how do we get a high-level understanding of what the Tau is supposed to be doing, what's the goes-intas and the goes-outas, and what does it do to the data as it goes in between?
We'll find another one. Do you any recommendations where we could go?
If you sneak into the Ed Center space.
Yeah, okay.
Using the code
for the old stuff. So the Tau was an independently bring-upable unit, and we'll start that. That way we won't be tripping over each other because there's already quite a few people working on the CPU and all the other aspects to get the basic machine up were being covered. So we did that. The first thing was what does it do? How does it work? What are the goes in and the goes outs? That started a massive document search. There was lots of documents in the archive. We just sat down with all the 14-01 documents, went through them all, looked for anything that talked about the Tau, We were concerned for quite a while we wouldn't find anything. It was a several-week process to dig through all the documentation. And then we found the field maintenance manual that had the tau flow charts to it. And that was the Rosetta Stone to understanding what the tau was supposed to be doing. Next step was to try to understand that, and in parallel with trying to understand the flowcharts, we'd start to think about, well, how are we going to bring this thing up? How do we get visibility to see what it's doing? The tau control panel gave pretty good visibility to the internal data flow aspects of the tau, but the major problem was what's happening on the tape channel. So we thought, well, okay, let's build a lights and switches box. That way we can see the interface and we could toggle switches to be able to get responses back and make it,
You were thinking of like a logic analyst or feature in the box originally?
Well, originally it was just dumb lights and switches.
To control things. Yeah.
But then as we read more into the tau, there was a lot of timing sensitive logic. The tau would start counters and you'd have to respond back. So then that grew into a smart lights and switches box.
So lights for status and switches for controlling signals.
Yeah, so we could intercept the interface and respond back. None of the tape drives were alive yet. And that was the time where we just found out we were going to have to rebuild all the clutches, and everybody was researching on what type of magnetic powder to use. And I'm thinking that, well, we may have the tau up before any tape drives come up, so I want to be able to stimulate the interface also.
Did that happen?
They came just about the same time. Okay. Alan got the first tape drive up as the tau was ready to talk to it on its first day alive, but we'd only beaten him by a week or something like that, getting it functional. The other thing that became clear was that with this much trouble with the mechanical parts of the tape drive and having trouble fielding the parts to do it, it seemed like you were going to have to cannibalize several tape drives to get one tape drive running. And I would hear people talk about, the people would have wet dreams about running sort 7 on the restored computer.
I still like
computer.
That. We still want to do that, Bob.
Yeah. So we were thinking that the only way that we're going to be able to have that many tape drives operational is to make them virtual. So if we've got something that's a smart stimulation box, we could make it a complete simulation, and not only it had a double effect. Number one, it would be able to simulate a tape drive, and number two, it would confirm our knowledge of what we were doing. If we were able to make it, we're basically building a software version of a tape drive inside this box, and
you can confirm what the tau control unit is doing.
Both sides.
Okay.
Yeah, that we were able to debug both. When there were mismatches in our understanding of it, we were able to debug them against each other. And we knew that if there was something wrong with the virtual version of the tape drive, it was a code problem and not a busted clutch or some actuator that's a little bit slower picking than it should be, that type of thing. So it was still a unknown type interface problem that you're debugging, but at least it was one class of problems where if there's a bug in the tape drive, it's a software bug. So that started stretching it into a full emulation capability. Then I started thinking about my experiences in high school. And in high school, I learned how to program Fortran first, and then I learned how to program assembly language. And what they gave us to learn assembly language was this little cardboard card that had the basic data flow of a machine on it. And they had little slides, and they had wheels, and you would turn things to move things through the data flow. And it reminded me a lot of what was printed on the front panel of the 1401, where it just showed the data. The architecture of the 1401 was about the same complexity as the this cardboard thing that we learned how to program on. So I was thinking, well, I got a lot out of those classes on how to program assembly, and it wasn't assembly code. It taught you how a machine really executed instructions. It was really a class in computer architecture. Nobody in the world's going to want to know AutoCoder, but AutoCoder will teach them how a computer processes instructions without all the little nasty things like worrying about index registers, without worrying about caches, without worrying about all the stuff we add to computers nowadays which are really unimportant to the basic understanding of how do you get a machine to run programs and to do things. So we started, instead of making it just a lights and switches box, we decided to architect the design so that it could be used in an education environment. Specifically, we envisioned students coming into the 1401 room with their program already created on their notebook computer. We wanted to link to their notebook computer, run the program from the notebook computer, put the results back on their notebook computer, and then they can work that way. So they would do all their programming offline, and at the same time, Ron Mack was doing the rope interface, so it seemed to dovetail perfectly with that, that they would be able to do their initial programming and their simulation to be able to test their programs, and then when it was all ready, they'd get some computer time, and they'd be able to just run the programs from their notebook computers. So that was the plan, and I...
Or a dream, I guess would be the word, right?
Well, it was a dream and a plan.
How much did that impact the design of the tower, though?
It didn't impact the design of the tower at all.
I mean, the tower later.
What the education aspect did and the desire to run a SART 7 is that, well, as long as you're going to emulate one tape drive, why not emulate a bank of six?
Yeah.
And it turned out that wasn't that hard to do once you've got
but
one of them.
The education idea doesn't require six.
But running SART 7 does.
Yes. Which I still want to run.
So, you know, there'd be a scenario, we thought best case you might have three tape drives running and you'd need three more that you'd have to make virtual. So that set the architecture of it, where we wanted to do something that would be able to start with some person's notebook computer in the room and go down to running the program in the 1401. As we checked it out, all the hooks were there. We wouldn't have to modify the 1401 to do that. It had a boot from tape capability built into it. And we fielded a team. We just put out the word to other people involved in the project who wants to work on this thing. And we got quite a bit of interest initially. We broke up the skills that we needed is that we needed to do some digital hardware. We wanted to do some analog hardware because the interfaces on the I.O. they're not straight digital signals. They're current switch signals. Plus, we were also thinking of being able to check out all the features of the Tau, so you'd want to be able to emulate a weak flux record on the tape and do bit dropouts and stuff like that. So the original plan was when you do architecture, you architect for that much and then you implement this much, right? So we did the architecture so we can do a significant amount of checkout of the checking mechanisms within the Tau to force errors and not just a tape drive. We wanted to emulate the Model 2, the Model 4, the Model 5, you know, everything.
Did you end up implementing all the error scenarios or some of them?
It's not brought to the user interface.
But you did.
But it's in the firmware.
It's in the firmware. Did you actually do it? I mean, did you actually run that firmware?
Yeah, we've got. We were able to do traces. We were able to do individual record dropouts, but we just don't have a good GUI interface for it. We have picture.
You say traces, you mean capturing traces. Right?
Yeah,
but just not in the GUI at this point.
No, it doesn't go all the way up to the GUI. So we had digital and analog hardware. We needed the firmware because we wanted to do a microprocessor approach and not build another tile out of circuits. That'd be too weird in those days.
Yeah.
And we needed to extend it to the web to be able to communicate with somebody's PC. So the original team was myself on the digital hardware and firmware. Grant Saviers signed up for the analog logic and participated in some of the digital too. And Jeff Stutzman was going to do the web programming for us. So we started that and we all started in parallel getting our stuff done. What came out in the first part of the design is Jeff did some studies as to how fast can we interface a PC to the hardware of the 1401 and get records back to the PC and stuff like that. And that was somewhat eye-opening. The first thing that we determined and made it seem possible is we found these charts, and they show the startup and slowdown times of the records, mm-hmm. and it basically gave us about 8 milliseconds between records to be able to do processing. So we thought if we can do the record processing local to the the smart box, mm-hmm. we call it emulator, mm-hmm. that if it could grab a record and process all the record in the firmware, then we could move the record, a record by record transfer between the emulator box and the PC in the 8 milliseconds that was allowed. Mm-hmm. Seemed like 8 milliseconds should be all day for a modern computer, given that things were running in the hundreds of megahertz at that time. And that was the plan, but his testing showed a few things. Number one, it showed the thing that you would sort of expect, that Windows is not a real-time system. And its interrupt latency, the tails going out on the interrupt latency are terrible. But secondly, not only the tail was terrible, but the base part of the distribution was terrible. Windows does not service data transfer interrupts from the USB bus on it using interrupts. Mm. It pulls once a millisecond to move the data transfers. Mm. And you combine that with the normal things happening with a PC. Well, first of all, a disk access, those were in the days of 6 to 8 millisecond disk seeks. So if you had to go to disk for anything, of course you couldn't go anything virtual, because if you paged in the middle of that, there goes your 6 milliseconds. So we were stymied for a while in that we can't move. In the 8 milliseconds we had available to us, there were problems on moving the data. Let me step back a little bit in what we chose, and that was what we're going to use for the basic hardware of the system.
Did you ever consider a real-time operating system instead of Windows?
Well, if somebody walked in with a notebook computer running Rogue, they'd be running, it's that computer we would have to move it to. I guess we could have done some sort of a hybrid system in what is the web server now. I stapled some things together. There it is. Trying to staple together. We looked around for what could we use for find for a compute module, mm-hmm. and we ran across that. And the really nifty thing about that is it had a USB bus built into it. The USB bus is hardwired into a FIFO, which is feeding an 8-bit processor. And it had 50 GPIOs. And looking at the parallel cable going to the tape drive, 50 was more than anything else we found. And although 50 wasn't quite enough, it turned out to be enough by multiplexing a few of the signals it was able to fit.
So this is the one you used it? DLP design, DLP 245PL. Mm-hmm. So does this company still exist?
I think so.
Okay, how does it compare to some of the other popular boards out there these days?
The DLP is the manufacturer of that board. They use a microchip PIC, 8-bit chip. And
is there many PIC processors out there?
There's lots of PIC processors.
USB module too.
Okay. FTDI USB module.
That's where they had their own custom ASIC.
Okay. So we read through that and it was, hey, it's got a built-in USB interface, because doing a design with a high-speed USB is a completely different level than what we wanted to approach, and the technology we had available. The logic that we built was wire wrap, and you can't do USB across wire wrap. It would have elevated it to having to build your own printed circuit boards and stuff like that. So it would have made things more complex. Being able to find the USB connected to a microprocessor was great. And it had a good amount of GPIOs. The processors, when we first got it, ran at 32 megahertz.
Wow.
So you had to do level shifting for the GPIOs, though, I assume.
Yes.
Yeah.
So But the processor had a simple architecture, and it ran 4 cycles per instruction. So you start with, it starts with an 8 megahertz clock. It does a times 4 for PLL, and then it divides by 4 for instructions because there's 4 cycles per instruction. So basically, 8 megahertz gave us 8 million instructions per second. Some instructions, the machine is very deterministic. Based on the instruction, it's either a 1-cycle instruction, 2-cycle instruction, and a taken branch off of a 2-cycle instruction becomes a 3-cycle instruction.
The pick part.
That's the pick part. So there's no cache, there's no memory management, there's no address translations. We would be able to program hardware speeds into it, and basically, by the time we got well into the project, a 10 megahertz version of it was out. So we were looking at it saying, okay, we get 10 inch, what was it? 10 megahertz clock oscillator would give us 10 instructions per microsecond. And looking at the data rates as to the 1401 had I think it's about a 10 microsecond cycle. The tape, the framing, frame by frame delivery of characters were a little bit worse than that. I think they're around 20 microseconds. So let's say 20 microseconds, I get 200 instructions per byte coming in. It's doable. If they gave me 5 instructions, you have to say no way. Or we'd have to rearrange the hardware, what the hardware does versus the software does, and put the buffering on the outside. And again, the hardware part of the project would start getting complicated. This is...
By the way, 10 megahertz was the speed of our first RISC processor at Sun.
How much memory did you get with that board?
It says all the memory is built into the PIC chip, and there was a whole, it's advertised here, 3,840 bytes of RAM.
That's why we have that limitation on the block on the buffer size, right?
Yeah, 128K of flash memory. It's a Harvard architecture where they completely separate the programming memory from the from the data memory. So you've got roughly 3K of RAM for everything. Well, because we had like 200 instructions to do something, and we've got a total RAM resource of around 3K, we decided to go with assembly language instead of a compiler. To be able to manage a compiler to use that small amount of resources would have taken a year just to understand the idiosyncrasies of the compiler. And usually the free compiler that these companies come out with is worth every penny of your purchase price.
Marketing was happy.
But I had programmed lots and lots of assembly language in my career, and it was not a problem. So this thing just plugged down into our logic board. That's the picture of the logic board, and this is where the module mounts here, and that USB connector comes out the back of the emulator board. So I had 3 major connectors, H1, H2, and H3 is what they call them. And the rest of this stuff is just small-scale TTL and level translators. So we just wrapped this board with level translators. This is the logic.
And Grant designed the level translators, I think?
No, the level translators were, well, he helped select the parts, but the level translator is just an op-amp.
From ECL to...
Yeah, these are the Gozintas with op-amps, and the goes out is our...
Current switched.
What was current switched?
All the long cable interfaces are current switched.
Okay. So you have an ECL, basically, you're trying to convert.
And so this is the minus N input the circuits, N. And there's another page for the P circuits,
there's
half of the cables, plus P and minus N. So that's... it's wrapped with a layer of buffers and and level translators. And pretty much logic is done inside the chip.
Okay. When I see all the receivers here, you have drivers as well. Oh, okay. Half drivers, half receivers.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So how did you... So every signal on the interface to the tape drive stream is here?
Yeah.
Okay. So you could drive any...
So the other thing that we did is the number one need for it was to see what they're doing, and that's our lights and panels, that's our lights.
connect, that's, oh, these were LEDs?
Yeah, those were LEDs on the front, so every signal in the tape bus, whether or not the emulator is driving it, is monitored. So you can watch transfers between the tape drive. If you're working with a tape drive and everything hangs, you can just look at the lights and see where it was in the transaction.
Oh, yes. I didn't realize you had that many LEDs. I looked at the box, but I never realized there was that many.
It's sideways.
That's about, what, 20 or so? No, 30 or so. 10, 20, 40. 10, 20, about 40 LEDs.
Yeah. That's a good number of them. So that's all the logic board is really, is level translators and an interface to the analog board. Analog board contains, the analog board is used for the incoming signals. And
well, there's some plus.
Actually, both data bus, in and out data buses both go through the analog board. And Grant has a series of analog multipliers. So we can load the other side, other input to the multiplier with the gain controls for every bit coming back and things like that.
You also need that. What kind of multiplier?
Analog multipliers. So we
change the frequency.
So I'm feeding him digital ones and zeros for data to send, mm-hmm. and he's going to change it to an analog stimulation on the bus. And if we want to do a flux dropout on the tape, okay. we just change the multiply value to something small.
Well, the threshold,
so you can test out that high threshold, low threshold module. Yeah. So the hardware, the hardware outside the module is trivial. Or the analog has got a little bit of complexity to it, but even then, it's just translation bit by bit.
That multiplication is in firmware only. It's not in.
No, it's a chip. It's an analog multiplier chip.
So those are
the digital schematics. They're separate schematics for the analog. I didn't happen to bring those.
So this got an input which takes an analog. The multiplier is an analog.
And that's the feedback loop and the op-amp. Just change the resistance of the feedback.
Yeah, but an analog.
Grant was affiliated with analog devices at that time, and he had some four-bit, three-quadrant analog multipliers that he knew about and designed in. And so I did do the layout. That's the picture of the analog board. This long connector connects it to the digital board. There's a power connector in, and
did you have any? No noise issues. You have separate power and ground plates, ILOs.
It's a wire wrap board. And we ran the red, blue, and yellow are the power busing between the circuits.
So there's no plate.
In TTL, you can do this.
Well, you think you can.
At the speeds that we're working.
Well, it's edge rates. Yeah, so all the edge rates were slow enough that you didn't have any crosstalk problems, noise problems. Mm-hmm. What are the edge rates, do you think?
I think it's LSTTL. Yeah, it's LSTTL. LSTTL was very friendly to wire up than their previous thing. So it was archaic, build in your garage type of hardware, and basically just we relied on this module to do just about everything.
So this thing sits on the end of the tau bus, which is a serial link, right? It goes from the tau to the first tape drive to the second tape drive to the third. Is it?
Yeah,
it's serial.
It didn't have to, but we designed it that way because it allowed us to cut some corners. We didn't have to have a cable in and out arrangement. We just had a cable in.
And terminators.
And there's terminators right here. Cable connector, no, it's cable connector, N terminators and P terminators. So there's two cards we plugged in with terminators.
And the 729 bus, it's a shared bus, and only one 729 is being spoken with at any given time.
On input, the read heads read the data, they run it through preamps, and that's it. It's off to the cable, and the rest is in the tower.
They allow it to be active or totally passive.
Yeah.
your box could be active and looking like six tape drives, or
yep.
it could be passive and watching what's going on the real tape drive.
Did you?
Because everything is bused parallel to the cables. You just pay attention to which ones you want, and the rules are you don't drive unless you've been selected. Mm-hmm. So as long as if we're passive on the bus, we will never become selective. We can record what we see.
So there's some really weird bit recovery logic in the TAL. You know, these where they're trying to look at the center of a cell. You know, this logic which you became very familiar with. You didn't try to emulate any of that logic in this board.
Yeah, we did. Well, not in this board.
In
there.
Board. Oh, in there, board. In firmware.
Yeah, that's what we did
with
our instructions per microsecond.
So you would sample the signal?
Yeah.
In firmware and decide where the center of the cell is in the firmware?
Yep. And I brought examples of that code. Because we were completely deterministic and an assembly code, with our cycle counts of exactly when we stimulate I.O. Within a frame.
You know, where you
it's nice.
You don't mean stimulate, you mean where you sample it. Where you sample.
When we would set a new output.
Okay, cool. So this page here was for setting an output?
That's the interrupt handling routine that would go off when we got a data strobe.
Okay.
And based on the data strobe coming to us, we would jump into that routine. There was a 3-instruction latency coming in there. And once we're there, we counted cycles to when we wanted things to move. And it was pretty much as precise as you'd be able to build it in hardware.
Is this listing for all the firmware?
No, it's just a few pages of that interrupt handler. That was the section where we really needed the assembly, because you can see a few sections of no-ups with the number of instructions that we had to meet the timings. We had just enough. We were able to make it fit. We came close to having to put more buffering on the outside, but we made it.
200 instructions.
How many lines of assembly rules did you write total?
I don't know, like 10,000.
You wrote 10,000 lines of assembly rules?
Yeah.
That kept you in 1 week.
The project was the firmware was a small piece of the project. Mm-hmm. We only had 128K, it had to fit.
So by the firmware then, did you try playing with adjusting the sampling point to detect the data to see if...
Yeah, the controls are in there. The specs talk about how the timers are set up to do the different changes. We could emulate the timing. Different tape speeds, different densities, and there's something to be able to put delays in, to throw framing off.
And you know there were 7 channels, right? They could all be offset from each other. Can you program each bit channel differently? And can the TAL do that? Skew? Can the TAL do that, or can you do that?
This would only be on virtual tapes, right?
Yeah. Well, in this case, yeah.
Well, when we're writing back, though, there was a way we'd be able to implement a timing scheme. I don't remember what it was.
Mm-hmm.
I think that may have been a feature of the analog board, where we'd
just
be able
to
add a delay into the analog board.
But per bit?
This dropped a full 7 bits out at a time.
Yeah.
The individual bit skews, I think, were done by the analog board.
So you could adjust them. You can adjust them bit, lane by lane, bit by bit.
I think so. I
don't find a delay on that board somewhere. Right.
So did you have trouble with that, though, is what I'm getting at? Did you take a long time before you could accurately read?
Well, we set everything to nominal and brought everything up with nominal, and then we went through a phase of the project later trying to test out the other pieces of it.
Mm-hmm.
And everything we in the spec, we have the picture of what we dreamed the interface would be to that part of the control mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
And we implemented the firmware and hardware pieces to do that. but we did, never brought the user interface up. So, and after the project was going for about 6 years, we petered out on new features.
So tell me all, in summary, all the features from top to bottom of the box that maybe aren't exposed in the GUI, if you can remember them all. Get the tip manual out.
It would be in the GUI.
But you told me there's some stuff that's not in the GUI, so I mean everything.
No, the GUI had everything in it. We wrote the firmware, so there was a hook for everything that was in the GUI. We just didn't implement the GUI except as a
okay, so in that sense, the GUI document is accurate. Then it just may not be that it describes accurate functionality, but there may not be a button in the GUI.
There's a PC interface which is defined from the PC to the to this board for every feature that's in the GUI. And the firmware has all the features implemented. We were able to exercise that part, and the hardware had all the everything to be able to support that. We did find out that because they were either two or three quadrant analog multiplexers instead of four quadrant analog multiplexers, we couldn't drop out individual bits in a record. We'd have to drop the entire record. It wouldn't recover fast. We'd get a bunch of bits. We couldn't recover fast enough. So that was something we found in the hardware when we were checking that part out.
So if you had that skew, though, you could skew one of the bits so long and effectively it dropped out, right?
Yeah. If that was coded, I'm pretty sure that was something that we looked at because it's a big part of the TAO to do that. And if there's a control in that GUI that allowed it, then we implemented the hardware to do it.
So
you could be in the PC, can't you? It's just not
we were able to it set control registers up for what byte in the record it would do it to, and then a mask that would be applied to the byte.
So with all those transactions defined, someone could just directly access the USB from the PC and not use the GUI and command some of these things that
you
did. That
so they're in the Java interface.
Mark could add these features.
Right.
For these our new GUI, if you wanted to, but I think the GUI is wonderful. But he could add these features that are missing. Mm-hmm. So, Bob, if I understand, is it conceivable then? I think the answer is yes. But you can take, this tip, call it the TAO anyway, whatever you call it, and kind of do a health check on the real TAO. In other words, because we know that the sampling of the bits in the TAO, we've seen bad transistors that resulted in bad acquisition of data from the 729s. Be nice if there was like a button that does.
So it's like a shadow. So you shadow the TAO and highlight any time.
A text. I'm thinking more of a text. Well, that would even be better.
Right.
But
then you can highlight any time what the TAO did wasn't consistent.
Wasn't consistent. Yeah, but even before you did that, just a test. Today we're going to test the health of the TAO. Mm-hmm. Right. And push a button and it. And
right. With the virtual drive and try all these skews.
Try all the skews and see how good it is at handling skews.
Right.
Coming from your artificial 729.
We looked at extending that part of the project, mm-hmm. and we're thinking, well, that's another year. And the TAO seems to be working just fine right now. And
because what happens a lot of the time, and Iggy and Joe, you guys should comment, but sometimes, ignoring issues like the Go signal being stuck and all the control stuff, but sometimes, because you guys run the diagnostic stuff, and you know how many bad records are read back, right? And have you ever had to adjust any of the timing in the TAO or change a board in the TAO because we had dropouts or data not being read back properly?
No, usually what I found out about Joe, what we found is that usually there's just dirt on heads.
There's what?
Just dirt.
On the heads.
Or a split dice. Yeah. And we cleaned everything up and everything started working fine.
Yeah, my father pushed here and taped down here.
Yeah.
Or we had some big problems too.
Yeah, or we had to adjust the preamps, or we found some busted wires on that swing gate.
Mm-hmm.
The wires are prone to breaking, or maybe sometimes the ground will go off.
We get all kinds of. We haven't found a bad card in the TAO that say reads data
one particular card.
Yeah. But I mean, it reads that decodes the data, the data path, not the control.
The TAO is 99% synchronous. And that's why it's got all these counters, the read counter, the write counter. And
but if there's a...
If usually what breaks, if it's going to be missing a strobe or something, mm-hmm. the counter's not counting right.
Right. It's usually the counter.
It's either a decode from the counter, it's probing six bits of the counter, and one of those bits, diode is broken on the card,
yeah.
and it's not seeing the bit, or the yeah. counter isn't counting the sequence, it's skipping numbers as it's counting, counts even numbers only.
Right. One was counter 2 or 64 or something, to get the data in or something.
Yeah.
We had a failure in that area one time, and not really doing at all.
Well, that would be very helpful for that problem we have. Tapes written on one machine and won't be read on the other at 200.
Well, we've got a problem right now.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Well, it doesn't affect our operation, but if you write in one density on one tape drive and move the tape to one system and move that tape to the other system, it's three days, and vice versa. You move the high density back and forth, or low density within the same system.
But it's low to low portability between the two machines.
Probably the high to high works, but
we've swapped the whole oscillators and counter things.
And isn't there just there's a low problem in one of the machines, the German machine or something, right? Where it can't read low density tapes.
Well, all the tape guys do it, not just low.
In the German machine, right?
If you write back and forth,
it's just crossed.
I mean, even if you're not crossing, isn't there a problem in just a machine by itself?
No.
It's only a crossing problem.
Yeah, individual machines work fine. Okay. Density.
So the low density on the German machine, if you write a tape, you go read it.
Okay.
Now, Dell had the problem where the Tau emulator at 200 BPI, one of the machines wouldn't. Like the German machine, the Tau emulator
doesn't.
That says the
Tau's
off on the German machine.
Yeah, okay, that's what I was thinking.
Because the German machine has got a strange ground because of the 50 mm-hmm. cycle converter, and there's bias levels set.
You talked about terminator resistors that would be different on the Connecticut and the.
Because Mark's moved the machine between both systems.
Yeah, there's a thing you're supposed to plug in and unplug because there's a threshold adjustment. It's this circuit here.
Because of the difference of the grounds?
Yeah.
You discovered this.
This is painful.
But high density.
Yeah, there's two. That's implemented on a 16-pin dip header,
mm-hmm.
and you plug one in for the German machine, one in
different
for,
wire.
And there's a pot on each, so you could set it for that machine.
Mm-hmm.
Because ground is not ground compared to the two machines, and trying to get those to pick the signals right doesn't work.
Is the other header attached to the door?
I don't know where the other
it's in a it should be in a plastic bag inside the case.
So. Okay. But you know, Mark's got it running correctly on the Connecticut machine. That one's perfect now. But he runs on the German machine. And some of the Tau functions don't work.
This could be the problem.
That sounds like that.
So this was due to a different ground voltage somewhere?
Yeah. We were looking at what was the problem, and we weren't seeing the signals
lifted off
coming in because the thresholds weren't right.
Would that affect the high density?
It
could. Low density, it could.
It depends how marginal the...
Oh, okay. So high density is
working. Yeah, but...
But since the Tau emulator is also having trouble with it, it's not just something about the tape that's,
When we first got the Connecticut machine, we looked at it and figured, what's wrong with this? And and we had to do a separate version of that to get the thresholds to come out right.
Okay. Now, I'm going to ask you a hypothetical question, going back to the German machine. If you hadn't have built the Tau, how much longer do you think it would have taken to bring up? I mean, the 729 emulator, maybe we should call it that. If you hadn't have built, I don't know what we're going to call it, right? But if we call it that, if you hadn't have built it, how much longer do you think it would have taken to bring up?
Well, we said we beat Allen with the first tripe drive by about a week. It came out close, but...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but then you had to
from
debug
the time
the
of being... Pardon me?
Then we had to debug the Tau, though.
No, the Tau was debugged with the emulator.
Right, but if you hadn't done that...
And when we connected to the tape drive, it worked first time.
Yeah, okay, but if you hadn't have done that...
If we hadn't have done that, it probably would have put an extra year on it.
Now, I do remember you getting a logic analyzer out once to debug a problem. Do you remember that? I have a picture of you.
That would have been after the level shifters, though, right?
Right. Yes. Maybe we got the HP logic analyzer on.
Because that doesn't handle negative going in.
I think we use, well, there's a, there's a,
it is a whole, it has a full range, minus 15 plus 15.
There's a logic analyzer test points section in there so we can watch the interfaces.
But you had to hook things right up into the tau. You were using this. Remember that? I have a picture of you.
Was it the tau or was it the line printer? I know I was using
the tau.
Halfway during the project, Ron requested that I shoot a print buffer problem.
Oh.
They were ready to get the print buffer working, and I needed the logic analyzer because we needed to be able to look across an entire line of characters coming in. Mm-hmm. So I needed the depth. I remember using the logic analyzer to debug the print buffer.
Okay, problem. Maybe that's what, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe that's what
but I'm pretty sure we used it on this also just to check the interface. But
okay. Just to debug this.
You converted it to TTL?
Pardon me?
That have been after you converted signals to TTL?
Yeah. Yeah, we would have probed here on the TTL
side. Well, he was programming the cards. It was with the odd levels we had in the machine. And look at the manual here.
Do we have a copy of that page somewhere back in local so we know where to make that adjustment for the ground?
You could have these.
Now, have you guys tried the tau?
Okay. I think these are all on the
have you guys tried the 7.9 emulator?
We don't need them. We are all given to Mark.
Have you guys tried this box? Have you ever tried it?
Check this out.
No.
No.
Okay.
Have you ever tried this box? Have you ever tried to use it?
No.
So, do you want to... Do you want to spend some time today? Well, it's too late now. It's 3 o'clock. But.
Yeah, but if we can keep this, I'm sure that we could, Mark could use especially this portion there.
Yeah.
If not, at least that page.
Yeah, we have all the documentation on the website.
Stan may need that also for the current mode inputs. You've got the C-Star inputs, you said, which are different from P plus and N minus, but.
C-Star.
No, it's really complicated plus for us because we put a resistor in series and put it up with the oscillator and it works. The value of that resistor, I don't know. So we're going to build a new one on a front circuit board, but we've got to figure out what values to use. And I'm going to guess that the optical oscillators today come in different packages and a lot better than what we did. Mm-hmm. We have one optical oscillator per chip.
This is the circuit we use to cheat current switch using an actual voltage sensor. We're not using current sensors because we couldn't find a convenient part.
So back to the bring up. Before I forget. So on the German machine, how long did it take you to get this whole thing built? Was it 1 year? Or two years?
3 years.
3 years?
To the time that the final schematics are end of 2008, beginning of 2009.
Okay.
Yeah, but how much time did you actually put in?
Were you spending 2 days a week?
No, we moved, because we were getting in each other's way, Ron and his team worked on Wednesdays, we worked on Thursdays.
Ron
Williams.
Ah, okay. So,
we did one day a week, hands-on. The programming we were all able to do at home, so.
So you felt that you had... Using this thing in 729 mode, you have and looking at the signals. Well, you had brought up the tau itself. You had validated the tau before, just 1 week before Alan Palmer connected real 729.
Yeah.
And how long did that process take you to validate the tau? Was it a year? Was that part of the last year or?
Probably 6 to 8 months during that. During that year.
Okay.
But by doing the firmware for the emulator, I had a deep understanding of what was happening inside the tau. Because I had to do software for every timing that was in the tau. I had the analog in the wrong word. But
right where to look for it.
Yeah. And the great thing it helped me do is I was able to understand the tau very deeply because basically I had built the tape drive that would talk to it in software down to the level that the lowest level the tau would understand.
Could one have connected, can one connect, I think the answer is no, could one connect a 729 directly to this box?
It'd be the same as connecting two 729s together.
Okay.
I mean, they don't do anything to each other. Mm-hmm. They need a tower to talk to them.
Yeah, I mean, there's not enough functionality to be a TAU.
No, it's not. There's no functionality to be a TAU.
Yeah.
It's got all the functionality to be a 729.
We've said confusing things about that. So I have.
Would add it to the complication.
You could do that, though, given probably if you wanted to.
Would add it to the complication of actually getting the emulator working. Added another year to the project to get there.
Mm-hmm.
As I told you, Jeff found out that there's no way we can meet these 8-millisecond deadlines that we had. Until we decided to bite the bullet and write a Windows kernel driver. So since we were living in the wonderful world of fast PCs with USB coming with gigabytes of memory, it was not a problem to permanently allocate. When the driver gets loaded, it permanently allocates a buffer in memory, which is in non-paged area of kernel memory, which is 6 × 25 megabytes.
Whoa.
Because a tape drive is 20 to 25 megabytes. And so you multiply all that out, and it's a couple hundred megabytes, but in a gigabyte memory, and we're not running really anything else in it, so the kernel's got plenty. And even in the, I think the PC's got about 3 gigabytes store of memory in it. You know, but even with 1 gigabyte, taking a few hundred megabytes out is, Windows uses that much just to fool around. So
were you running a process in there, a driver that was interrupt free while it was busy?
At the kernel interrupt levels, not real interrupts, because USB doesn't use real interrupts. It's a software-created interrupt based on the USB polling. We're able to handle the entire record transaction and write it to the 25-megabyte buffer for that tape within the 8 milliseconds. Now, when you upload from the PC to the web server, on the way in, we convert from ASCII to real SIMH format. The buffers that we're using inside the kernel space emulate the SIMH tapes. Every record has got a pointer, a length in front and a length behind it. So it's a 4-byte counter. So you could span it going forward or backward, scanning the logical tape. So we implemented the SIMH formats inside the kernel. So the interrupt handler just steps to the next record. It knows how many bytes to send, grabs that, puts it in a URB buffer, passes it down the chain to the USB mechanism, and sends it out. So we solved all of the timing problems by never having to leave the kernel for the movements. The non-kernel code just translates from these SIMH buffers to ASCII and out and across the web.
Is that translation between ASCII and SIMH done in the PC?
Yes.
Good.
Now, by the time it, you're loading the buffer or taking it out, so it's not while the tape drive's operating, it's in the setup.
While it's in the buffer, it's using the tape bit patterns. Mm-hmm. It's left justified. So there's no translation that has to occur.
So that translation that happens outside of the kernel is not time sensitive at all because it's happening, it's set up.
Yeah, the entire tape is translated to this encoding as it goes into those buffers. And no, you can't have more than a 25 megabyte tape because you'd have to redefine the kernel buffers. I mean, you could probably ask for memory and XP would be happy. And that's the other problem, is because they're XP Windows drivers, which was the state of the art we went there when we did it. In Vista, they changed the driver models. So you'd have to go to any newer operating system, you'd have to upgrade the driver models. It's probably not a big deal, but.
Is that what Mark was facing?
No, it works for me, XP.
Oh, yeah, it's okay.
But he is sort of interested in the bigger memory.
Yeah.
That's that.
Yeah, they...
Would you be willing to work with Mark on that if he wants to upgrade the PIC process with us?
I'll advise.
Advise.
I don't want to get into more... I don't want to get into another eight-year project. Or...
Mm-hmm. It's kind of cool he's willing to take it on.
Of course, Mark has about 45 years of projects he's got mentally committed.
But then it keeps going up, too.
Yeah, it does.
Go down.
Every week he gets more.
He's got that disease.
In the data world, I don't think you're ever going to see bigger than 3K records for the 1401, especially since the base machine only shipped with 1400.
Almost none of those systems were delivered. I think only a dozen were delivered. It was that entry point.
But still...
The Fortran tape is in, I think.
IBM did it with their software tapes to load the compilers and the big programs. So those can just be pre-processed to...
We should be able to pre-process it, Didn't Van do that or something? Van made a version of it.
Even in the 360, 370 days, your standard blocking was 1600 to 2400 characters. You never exceeded that.
Yeah. Yeah, we can get it fixed. All right. Well, this is cool. But it would be fun. It would be fun...
In retrospect, knowing how much it took to do, would you have signed up for it?
Knowing that. I didn't want to ask that question.
If we would have thought the Computer Museum was as disinterested in running any kind of secondary education off of the 1401, then we would have. We would have done a smart lights and switches.
Well, so we had kind of... Okay, so that was the nature of my earlier question, Bob, which is how much did that goal impact the work that needed to be done? And it seems to me that all this work needed to be done just to get the 729 emulation mode working properly, to get the tau debugged properly.
We could have accepted records and thrown them away instead of shipping them A+.
But what do you mean? We love being able to download programs using this thing. We do it all. We do it a lot.
That wasn't part of the spec.
But we do it, though, right?
He could have brought it up without having virtual tape drives or any of this stuff.
But that's not where all the time went into. It went into making these boards and writing how many lines? 10,000 lines of firmware? I mean, what he's saying is, did the benefit equal all the work? From my perspective, it did. Because you became...
Well, we could have taken a shorter route. Hmm.
Like what? What corner could you have cut?
All the time that we spent working on the web programming, but there's probably 100,000 lines of Java behind it.
Oh, so not just the GUI, but you...
Tens of thousands.
Not just the GUI, you're saying, the web interface itself.
Yeah, it uses Java EE, and okay. Servlets that run.
Okay.
We built it around the Tomcat 6 web server. Uh-huh. So
that stuff was not used.
There's a lot of Java that was done for it. All the trouble we had trying to solve these problems to ship the records across to the PC would have been
screwed. So there's now an education department here. You know, they built this whole big room over here where they think they're going to bring kids in and they're going to do fun projects with things. We don't know what. I don't think she's figured out what she's going to do in there yet.
I don't think it has anything.
But if you're interested in engaging with the museum on... Well, it could be maybe... See, one thing I think that the staff is missing, no one here would disagree, is they don't have programming experience, you know. To them, everything is always just applications and, you know, and programs you run. But there are a lot of people here at the museum who would be interested in teaching basic programming one way or another. It'd be these little simple robots you could control, you know, remotely. You know, the 1401 programming could be in an advanced class for eighth graders. I mean, you know... But there's
a fairly that's a 1401.
No.
What I think is going to make the difference is that they can finally get a gut level feeling as to how a machine
works.
Is able to run a straight program.
Right.